Yeshuvot, Murag Rabotai, ladies and gentlemen, our rabbis teach us that in Judaism there is no accidents. Everything that happens to people through Jewish life, it's meant to be. Which means, as the Rambam writes in Berashat Bo, En mikre ba'olam kol ma'asenu nisim. Whatever happens to us, it's a miracle. And if somebody wants to know what's about in his life to happen that week, he should look at Perashat HaShavua, the portion of the Perasha, and from there he will learn how his life is going to be. And look how curious is this Perasha. In this Perasha, Yosef, a very young leader, is bringing his family from Israel to Egypt. Isn't it amazing? I was telling now Rabbi Kotler that Likud became the new Jerusalem. It's a place where you can live like a regular Jew. And also, I'm very honored to see exactly what Yosef looked like. We have a big rabbi who's very bright, same as Yosef. We have to say he's a big Torah scholar as Yosef. He's very intelligent as Yosef was. He's very bright. He was called the Avrech. Av bechokhmah, rach b'shanim. Which means he's very smart and he's very young. He's also very handsome, Jenny Salintima. But not handsome the way we look at people. He's handsome because he's bright, because he's kind, and that's important part in your religion, same as Yosef. But the most important thing about him, Rabotai, is that he's keeping the people united. Somebody just told me that he's the only one who's able to bring 200 people on a Shabbat afternoon to a shul where if he doesn't show up, people do not appear. And I'm witness of that. Last Shabbat, my dear teacher and friend Rabbi Mansur wasn't here, and the shul of Ahiezer looked different. Let me tell you my experience with Rabbi Mansur. I have learned with many Rabbanim, but I'm proud to tell you that I never learned better in my life, and I was never skipping a class, no matter what happens, because I'm learning with him. I enjoy his learning. My father always teach me that if you want to know if people like you, it's because God likes you. If God doesn't like you, it's because people doesn't like you. It's written in Pirkei Avot, Kol sheruach hamakom nochah imenu, Kol sheruach habriyot nochah imenu, ruach hamakom nochah imenu. When people like you, you like by people. So I ask now Chacham Mansur, how do you feel, Rabbi, to be loved for so many people? Everybody is here tonight because they love you, because they admire you, Rabbi. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to introduce you. A leader, my best teacher, my best friend. Thank you for being yourself, Rabbi Mansur. Thank you. This is Rabbi Eli Mansur, gentlemen. Thank you.
Revered Rashi Yeshivot, rabbis, dignitaries, family and friends. Moshe, you asked me, how does it feel to be loved? I can tell you, it feels great. I'm a lucky man. God was good to me. I wish I had time to tell you the story, how it's possible that a mainstream Syrian boy that graduates from the mainstream schools in our community can end up one day speaking from such a pulpit, and I have great humility as I stand in front of this pulpit. I'm surrounded by some of the greatest minds in the Jewish world, some of the greatest Talmidei Chachamim. How is it possible that a mainstream Syrian boy can be here? Undoubtedly, Borei Olam was with me. He guided my able parents. God should give them long life. They've made very tough decisions against the grain, against social pressures, against my own will. I did not want to go to yeshiva. I went begrudgingly. As a matter of fact, I told my father when he sent me to yeshiva high school, an all-boys high school, which was unprecedented in our community in 1982. And I told my father, I'm not going. It's not for me. He said, you have to go. You have no choice. I said, I will spit in the Rosh Yeshiva's face and get thrown out. He said, go ahead and do it. You guessed well, I didn't do it. I was mesmerized by their Torah. And isn't it a coincidence? Most of the rabbis that influenced me were products of Lakewood Yeshiva. Rabbi Diamond is sitting at the dais. He taught us in high school. Today is Rosh Kollel and Deal. I learned with some Talmidim of Rav Aaron, a rabbi called Rav Chaim Weintraub, that I learned Chavrusa with for many years. And I had the privilege to learn with a man that made a great impact on my life, Rav Zev Tukutsky Shlita. And Baruch Hashem, I was able to make it and study in this bastion of Torah. My dear friends, gentlemen, Syrian men, you deserve to go see what's going on in this yeshiva. Rabbi Orgenbaum, who's a close friend, took me to the yeshiva the other day to see what's going on. I had a tear in my eye, nostalgia. I visited the different rooms where I studied different gemariyot with my good friends. And I remembered where I sat, and I remembered all the good memories that I had from yeshiva. And I got a charge, I got a chizuk. I saw my brother David that's still learning in the yeshiva. I saw my brother-in-law, Rabbi Eliyahu Sutton, that's still learning in the yeshiva. The yeshiva is very dear to our family. And I think you must, and you owe it to yourself to see it. The Rambam visited the great city of Aleppo, Halab. And the Rambam writes in his letters that I visited and traveled the Middle East, and I was impressed in the city of Halab because it was a city of scholars. The Shlach HaKadosh visited Halab, visited Syria, and he said he was treated with royalty, and he was afforded the opportunity to give shi'urim, and the men in Syria, the businessmen, understood the shi'urim of the Shlach, and they appreciated his Torah. Ladies and gentlemen, we must bring back this crown of Sephardic Torah to our community. And they are studying this Torah in Lakewood. The Torah of the Rambam, the Torah of the Ritva, the Torah of Rabbeinu Yonah and Rabbeinu Nisim and the Meiri and all the great Rishonim. We must support this yeshiva because our community is lacking something. Baruch Hashem, there's a renaissance in our community of Torah. People are thirsty. There's Torah centers opening up on every block. Kolelim, ladies' classes, men's classes for all ages. But we need rabbis. We need quality rabbis because our community demands quality. And they settle for nothing less. And Lakewood is producing quality rabbis. Rabbis of stature, scholars that are on a campus, that get to share their ideas with great minds. And we need to support them because in supporting Lakewood, we're supporting the infrastructure of our community. Because these boys will come back. And they will teach our children. And they will guide our community that needs great help, especially in these troubling times. Supporting Lakewood is a supporting the Syrian community. And I'd like to thank all of you for attending tonight. It means the world to me. I know it was a great effort to be here. You know, one of the men came to me and said, Rabbi, I'm coming for you tonight. I sent a great check to BMW. I said, BMW, it's BMG. I said, only a Syrian will make a mistake between BMG and BMW. But I'm sure it must have been a nice check if it was made out to BMW. I really appreciate that you all came tonight. A special acknowledgement to my grandfather, Joe Safty, that is still learning in Lakewood Yeshiva. He goes every day and studies there with my brother-in-law and my brother. Of course, to my parents and in-laws and friends. And like I said, it feels great to be loved. And I'm only here today because I have such a great community that supports me. And I'm here because of my rabbis, and most of all, I thank Borei Olam, Shegemalani Kol Tuv, Amen. Thank you.
Beruchim Abayim, ladies. We're studying Parashat Vayigash, which is the climax to a most interesting story when Yosef finally reveals himself in front of the brothers. And no matter how many times we read this story, even though we know the ending, even though we know what's going to happen, it's still just as exciting when we hear the Hazan, when he gets to the Sefer Torah part, when it says, Ani Yosef Ha'od Avi Hai. And everybody says, wow, unbelievable, tremendous. It's a story that recurs from year to year, and the lessons that we learn from this story are also endless. Yehuda has a great confrontation with Yosef. He starts to talk to him a little tough. He realizes that he must win this confrontation with Yosef and get Binyamin out. Binyamin is now in captivity. And he knows, Yehuda, how much is on the line if he doesn't win. And therefore he's challenging him and he's trying to show him that Yosef is not being straight with the brothers. Because if Binyamin doesn't come back, Yehuda put his eternity on the line. He told Yaakov Abinu, I guarantee he'll come back. And if not, I forfeit my Olam Habba. And that's an amazing stake that Yehuda is willing to risk. And that's the only reason why Yaakov acquiesced. Because if a man's willing to give up his eternity, so he's probably going to come through. So Yehuda had to make sure that he wins this argument. At the end, he wins. Everybody won. When Yosef says, I'm Yosef, I'm your brother, everything's going to be okay. Binyamin will come home, or Yaakov better will come to Egypt, everybody will be together, the family will be united. So technically Yehuda, he lucked out. He didn't lose his Olam Abba. There was a moment there where it was teetering, but in the end, it worked out. But I want you to know what the Gemara Makot writes. Gemara Makot writes that actually Yehuda did not gain entry to Olam Haba as fast as the other brothers. As a matter of fact, the Gemara says his bones were rattling in his coffin for the 40 years that the Jewish people were in the desert. Remember when the Jews left Egypt, each tribe carried their father. So the tribe of Yehuda had their father's casket. They carried and they took care of it. Eventually he was to be buried in Israel. All the other tribes, you didn't hear anything coming out of their casket. They were dead. But in Yehuda's casket, you heard noise, you heard unrest, you heard an unsettling situation. His bones were clanking. And for 40 years it was like that. And our rabbis tell us it meant that he was at unease because he did not gain entry to eternity. They wouldn't let him in. Until Moshe Rabbeinu, before he died, made an unprecedented prayer. And he asked God, please, you have to let him in. Yehudas, he's deserving. What was Moshe Rabbeinu's prayer exactly? He said, listen, God. Reuven, who was another tribe, Reuven made a mistake in his life. Reuven's mistake was he switched his father's bed from one tent to another without asking. It was a sin. Yehuda, he did a great thing in his life when he admitted, as we explained last week, the relation that he had with Tamar. He got up in front of everybody, says, it was I did it, I'm guilty. When Reuven saw Yehuda's honesty, that he was able to confess for a sin, Reuven said, if my brother confesses for a sin, I also can confess for my sin. And he got up and said, what I did with my father's bed, I'm guilty. So who was the cause for Reuven to become a true Baal Teshuvah? Yehuda. So Moshe Rabbeinu tells God, it's not fair. If Reuven gets Olam Abba, that's only on the account of Yehuda. Yehuda caused Reuven to make Teshuvah, and he's not going to get Olam Abba. When God heard that prayer, it says his bones connected, it was finally settled, and they led him into Olam Abba, and then it says how he prayed to be accepted, and they brought him to the first row. Only question is, we don't understand why. Why that happened to him? I thought he made good on his condition. It's not like he didn't bring back Binyamin. He brought back Binyamin. There was no reason for him to lose it. And the rabbis come and learn a lesson over here. How powerful speech is. How powerful words are. Especially words of a tzaddik. When a tzaddik says something, even if it's on a condition, even if he makes a stipulation, only if this happens, the words of a tzaddik are so strong that they even come true, even if the condition is met. Our rabbis learned from me how careful you have to be with words. A lot of times in anger, we say things. We say things that we don't expect to ever happen. We say a word, even words that, slang words, I'm going to die, I'm going to kill you. Heavy words like that, we should refrain from using. Because the mouth is a terrible weapon. And sometimes when the words come out, and who knows if they take the words literally, and you never meant them to be taken literally, sometimes they happen regardless. Even though I didn't mean it. Yehuda had the biggest claim. God, I should get Olam Abba. I made good. Yeah, but you said it. Once you said, take away my Olam Abba, they heard that part of their sentence. The other part of the sentence, they forgot about, so to speak. The lesson from Yehuda is, Chaim Tovim, be careful on the language that you use, especially when you're talking to your children. If you don't go to bed, I'll kill you. Be careful. Only talk. I'll punish you. It's not going to be good. There's going to be consequence, but not heavy, disastrous words that are negative. God forbid we say, Al tiftach pe le satan. Don't let the satan hear something where he can hold on to it and then make it happen, God forbid. Yosef, and probably the most famous words in the Perashat, finally admits to his brothers. I'm actually amazed when I read the Pesukim. I'm noticing it now. It says, Velo yachol Yosef litapek. He couldn't control himself. He sees the brothers. This is like the third confrontation already. He sees the pain that they're going through. And he hears Yehuda. He's giving everything he got. Please, you can't do it. He sees them in distress. He couldn't hold back anymore. He was ready to break down. So what does he do? He tells everybody get out. All the Egyptians, all the different people that were there. He calls out, Get everybody away. He didn't want to embarrass the brothers. You know, now it's a personal thing between him and the brothers. He's going to reveal himself. What do the Egyptians have to know this story for? What do the Egyptians have to witness? The brothers get embarrassed when Yosef finally says, I'm really Yosef. It's embarrassing. It's shameful. Look at the self-control Yosef has. He never loses control. These are great men. And to show you their character traits, they were controlling them. They held the reins on their character. You know, sometimes you can't control yourself, so you want to cry, you want to do something. You're not thinking now, are the Egyptians in the room? Are they not? Are they going to get embarrassed or not? The Pasuk's telling us he couldn't control himself. That means he did something over here supernatural by controlling himself. Because naturally there was no way. At that point, Yehuda was pushing his emotional buttons. Yehuda was pushing all the buttons of Yosef. He got him. Yosef had to break down. But he was able to control it for another 10 seconds. And he had enough clarity of thought to say, wait, I have to hold it in for another 10 seconds. Because there's Egyptians in the room. And my brother's going to get embarrassed when I do it. Shows you the mastery. They were masters. They had such control of every step that they didn't just do things and then regret. And say, you know what, if I could have done it all over again, I would have waited another 10 seconds. Every step was calculated. Every move that they made, they thought, what's going to happen if I do this? What's not going to happen? To show you the self-control of these great giants. And then he tells them, Ani Yosef, Ha'od Avi Chai, I am Yosef, is my father still alive? Ve'lo yachilu echav la'anot oto. And the brothers were spellbound. They couldn't answer him. They were shocked. And the Gemara writes on this, Oy lanu miyom hadin, Oy lanu miyom atocheha. Woe to us on the day of judgment. Woe to us on the day of reproof. If Yosef, who was the smallest of the tribes, was able to give a strong rebuke to the brothers, and they couldn't answer it, they were spellbound. What's going to happen when we go to God after 120 and God is going to start to rebuke us? How are we going to answer? If they couldn't answer Yosef, who was the smallest of the tribes, what are we going to answer God? And we look at the Pasuk and we don't find any rebuke over here. You want to call it a revelation? It's a revelation. He didn't tell them, you fools, you bums, you sold me, you good for nothing. That's a rebuke, I understand. What did he tell them? Ani Yosef, I am Yosef, is my father still alive? That's conversation, that's nice. He could have laced into them. He didn't. But the Gemara understands in those few words, Ani Yosef, I want to be high. Wow, what a rebuke. And the brothers took it as a rebuke. Because you see, they were, oh wow, he got us. We're shambled, we can't answer. And then they say, if they couldn't answer that rebuke, how are we going to answer our rebuke? Oy lanu miyom hadin, oy lanu miyom atochecha. The famous answer to this question, which you know already, but there's certain chiddushim on parasha that are the classics. Even if you know them, out of respect to the immensity of the thought, you have to say them over again. This must be repeated from year to year. It's said from the Beit HaLevi. He says, you know what happened over here? Yosef was giving them a great tochacha. What does the word tochacha mean? It's a rebuke that points out the contradiction of man. It proves to man that he's a hypocrite and that he's two-faced and that in certain times he acts one way and other times he acts another way. Tochacha shows the inconsistencies of man. In this case, it's blatant. Yosef has been talking to the brothers in several conversations. Do you have a father? The brothers say, yes, we have an old father. Hazit, he's an old man. Please, you can't take Binyamin from us. When our father hears that Binyamin is taken into captivity, he's going to die. He's sick. He's sick about this whole situation. Please, King of Egypt, have mercy on our poor father. That was their whole alibi this whole time. Please do it for the old man. Do it for Yaakov. It's going to hurt him. It's going to kill him. That's the whole claim during the whole story. Please have mercy on Shimon, our father. Please, he won't be able to handle it. What are we going to tell our father? So Yosef looks at them in the face, and Yosef says, Ani Yosef. I'm Yosef that you sold 22 years ago. Is my father still alive after what you put him through? You're so worried about your father. What is my father? He's going to cry. He's going to get upset. You use that excuse very conveniently. How come you didn't think of that 22 years ago when you sold me? So you're fakers. You don't have respect for your father. He wasn't asking them a social question, is my father still alive? He was saying, is my father still alive after what you did to him? After the anguish that you put him through? And you come along like tzaddikim and say, our father, you don't care about your father. You're inconsistent. You're hypocrites. That was all in those few words. And the brothers saw the paradox. They couldn't answer. They got caught. And our rabbis tell us this is exactly what's going to happen at the day of judgment. God is not going to only rebuke us. Why didn't you give charity? That's a rebuke. But he's going to show us how inconsistent we were in behavior. Because we'll answer, well, we didn't have money. Oh, you didn't have money for charity. But when it came to spending on luxuries, when it came to spending on extras, on non-essential things, then you had all the money in the world. Oh, so for this you didn't have money, and for this you did have money. And when a fellow bar mitzvahs his son, and he goes to the sofer, and he's haggling with him on the tefillin, $500, it's too much money, highway robbery, the rabbis are making a business out of it. But when it comes to paying the florist, he pays full dollar. He tells the florist, I want the best. Money is no object. This fellow will come to God. And God will say, why did you chinch out when it came to your son's tefillin? Ah, money, it was too much money. Tefillin's a lifetime investment. For that you didn't have money. For flowers that will be dead in an hour, that you spent all the money in the world. A fellow builds a home. When it comes to buying all the furnishings, he buys the best. When it comes to even the doorknob, he chooses the best, the most good-looking doorknob. But when it comes to the mezuzah that's placed on the door, then he starts to economize. Then he starts to tell the sofer, very difficult, give me the cheapest. Is there a $20 mezuzah? Is there a $15? What do you mean $80? I don't pay $80. For the doorknob, you spend $500. But for the mezuzah, we're not saying don't spend $500 for a doorknob. Just be consistent. Be consistent. Spend $500 for the doorknob and spend $100 for the mezuzah. Buy the best of everything. But don't use an excuse and say, no, I can't. When it comes to matzot on Pesach, we complain, matzah shemura, $15 a pound. It's crazy, who could spend such things? But when we go to a fancy Italian restaurant and spend $30 for spaghetti, then no one has a question. We pride ourselves, it's a fancy place, it's good. But for matzah, we're haggling. It's expensive, it's not right. God is going to show us all these inconsistencies. And it came to pasta, you had no problem to burn money. But when it came to matzah, then you're complaining. Be consistent at least. Don't use excuses conveniently in order to answer up. Oy lanu miyom adin. Oy lanu miyom hatochecha. A person might say, in yeshiva they used to teach us, a person might tell God, I had no time to learn. I was busy, I was involved, work, and so on, pressures, family. And then they'll show us, you had no time. But for the things that were important to you, you had time. You had time to read a newspaper for 25 minutes every day. He had time to get involved in television, God forbid, computers and so on and so forth. That you had time for. But for learning, you didn't have time. And we're not going to be able to answer. We're going to be spellbound. I say, that's so inconsistent. If you could remember this Hadusha for 120, you'll be smart enough. Don't say anything. When they come along and say, why didn't you? Just say, I'm guilty. You're right. Don't start. Once you start to answer, then already we're doomed. Because everybody has... it's Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. We live in paradox. We live in contradiction. There's... Yeshiva, when the boys would get up late sometimes for minyan, the rabbis would always give the example and say, you claim that you're tired. You claim that you can't wake up. You claim that it's difficult to rise up early in the morning. But remember when you went away for winter vacation and you had a flight that you had to be at Kennedy at 7 o'clock in the morning. You had no problem. 5 o'clock you were up, you were dressed, you were downstairs, your luggage in the car running. And you only slept for 3-4 hours. Here you got 6 or 7 hours and you complain. The contradiction. A secular Jew once said... Actually, Rav Chaim Ozer, Grzinski, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, he went to a secular Jew to collect money. They were building a mikveh. And this fellow did not understand the value and the importance of a mikveh. He said, Rabbi, today, where we have baths in the home, we have showers, the hygiene is very, very modernized. We're up to date when it comes to these things. In the olden days, they didn't have showers or baths, so mikveh was important. The ladies should clean themselves periodically. But today we don't need a mikveh. I cannot support something I don't understand. And as he's saying that, the rabbi takes out a cigarette, and the rabbi was with another rabbi. So the rich man takes a match out. He lights the rabbi's cigarette. He lights the other rabbi's cigarette. He puts the match out. He lights a second match and lights his own cigarette. So the rabbi said, well, what's the matter? You can't light your cigarette from the same match? He says, don't you know, Rabbi? It's bad mazal to use one match for 3 cigarettes. So the rabbi says, this you understand, but mikveh you don't understand. We're involved in such fairy tales and such things that don't mean anything. People carry rabbit's foot. They're scared of Friday the 13th. And when they're scared of black cats and they won't walk on the ladders. This, they have no problem following something they don't understand. But when it comes to telling them you have to check your suits for shatnez, well, it doesn't make sense to me. Well, everything in your life that you do, you have rationale. When it comes to the rabbit's foot, you do it. You don't understand why you're doing it. But when it comes to kashrut, you question, why call it kashrut? Why do I have to do this kashrut? What doesn't make sense, milk and meat? Why? I don't understand. God will show you the inconsistency of your behavior. The way when it came to things that you wanted to do, you didn't need reasons. Things that you didn't want to do, then you demanded, I need a logic. Oy lanu! This was a bitter rebuke that Yosef gave the brothers. There's another explanation what the rebuke was. Some rabbis explained it as follows. The brothers, for 22 years, they felt that what they did to Yosef, they felt they were right. They felt that Yosef was pursuing them. They felt Yosef wanted to kill them. And they felt that the judgment that they passed against Yosef was justified. And therefore, they had no guilt, they had no compunction. For 22 years, they believed they were right. And then, when Yosef comes and in two words says, Ani Yosef, what was he actually saying to them? You were wrong. You thought I wanted to kill you? If I wanted to kill you, I could have killed you 10 times already. You were in my palace over here. I could have killed you with no evidence. There would have been no remains of you. If I wanted to kill you, I could have done it. You made a mistake. You read it wrong. And that's the biggest rebuke that a person can receive in his life. That the path that he thought he was taking was correct, and then he wakes up one morning and he realizes, you're making a mistake. You are on the wrong path. You were wrong. It's crushing. And that's what's going to happen, la'atid lavo. Instead of the words, Ani Yosef, God is going to say two words. Ani Hashem. And that is going to be a great rebuke. Because many people are going to realize the wrong path that they took. People get involved with materialism. They get involved with the pleasures of this world. Spiritual priorities become secondary. They become third or fourth on the list. People neglect their soul. And they get involved with worldly pleasures. And they think that this is the path that will lead them to eternity or to happiness. And then God, in two words, is going to say, Ani Hashem. I am God. This should have been your priority. And we're going to reflect on our life and say, for 70, 80, 90 years, we were on the wrong course. We made a mistake. We lived our lives in lie. And there is no greater crushing rebuke than that, to realize that you were wrong. It's even difficult to be wrong for a few minutes. When you have an argument with your friend, and you say something and somebody contradicts you and say, no, you're making a mistake. It's difficult to admit that we made a mistake. Even we were only wrong on an insignificant fact. I heard that there was 300 people there last night. No, you made a mistake. I asked them, it was 700 people. You feel bad. You said 300. You were wrong. You were proven wrong. That's an insignificant matter. Big deal. 300, 700. But the fact that we've been proven wrong in life, even for 10 seconds, it's very difficult for us to deal with it. Imagine living a lifetime lost on a wayward road. And then God is coming to put life in focus by saying, Ani Hashem, I was the priority. And you're going to see it and you're going to say, wow, this is the action. This is God. This is life. This is what it's all about. We are not going to be able to handle this rebuke and this reproof from Borei Olam. That was the Musar that Yosef gave the brothers. Pasuk continues, Yosef now consoles the brothers and said, please, don't be upset. Don't get angry. Ki mechartem otihena, that you sold me here. Ki lemechya shilachani Elohim lefnechem. Listen, everything worked out for the best. God obviously did this. He wanted me to come down to Egypt to set up the economy in order to feed you and feed my father. So it was meant. You shouldn't feel bad about what happened. It was destined. He was appeasing them. He was saying, you know, don't lose sleep over it. It's okay. I forgive you. And our rabbis learned a great lesson. Benu Yeruham, one of the great rabbis of Musar, he learns actually a phenomenal ethical obligation from this approach that Yosef took with the brothers. He brings a midrash. The midrash says that God told the people, and it's written in the Torah, that every day in the Beit HaMikdash we had to light a menorah. We had to light candles, not only on Hanukkah. Every day in the Beit HaMikdash, the Kohen had to go, clean out the menorah, light it, all seven candles they lit every day. And they would last from the night till the next afternoon. So it was a miracle every day in the Beit HaMikdash. So God says, why am I telling you to light? Do I need your light? Does God need the light of the Jewish people, the Beit HaMikdash? As if God is in darkness and we're coming along and lighting up. God says, I am the light of the world. So why am I asking you to light a menorah? Why am I asking you to turn on a menorah every day? So he says, because when you were in the desert for 40 years, I provided light for you. You have to understand, the Jewish people were in the Midbar, there's no lampposts. At night, it's pitch black. Sometimes when you go to the country, you go to deal in the winter, in the summer, it's dark. Certain streets you can't see, there's no lights. Could you imagine in the midbar? In a desert, there's no cars, there's no store lights, there's zero. Once nightfall sets, you can't see your finger in front of your eyes. God miraculously provided them light. It was bright. There was a cloud, there was fire. So God says, listen, I provided you light 40 years in the midbar. Now I'm asking you, give some light in the Beit HaMikdash. So the Ben Yeruham learns a great lesson from this midrash. As if God is telling the Jewish people, now it's payback time. I did you a favor. Now reciprocate. How does this affect us, he says. He says, many times, to me it's a great musar. Many times, people do us a favor. They go out of their way, they do us a chesed. And now, we come to them and we tell them, how can I pay you back? How can I reciprocate? What can I do for you? And what do we answer? Don't worry about it. Forget about it. Leave it. My pleasure. It's nothing. You don't have to do anything. He says, that might not be the most ethical answer. Because why? Because when you tell a person, forget about it, don't worry about it, you don't have to do anything for me, you're keeping that person obligated to you forever. He becomes beholden to you now. Every time you see him, I did him a favor, he owes me. By not letting him reciprocate back, you hold him to you now. Now as if forever, he's bound to you. Because you won't let him, yeah, don't leave it, not necessary. So now in your mind, he's never released. So you own him. And he feels himself obligated. God is telling the Jewish people, I did you a favor for 40 years. I'm going to let you reciprocate. Please reciprocate. I want you to light a menorah. The lesson is sometimes when people come to you and say, let me reciprocate, the Rabbeinu Yeruham says, you tell them, you know what? You can do me a favor. I needed this thing over. If you can help me out with this, it would be a big favor. They would love to do it for you. But now you've evened the score. Now you release them. Now they feel good. Now you don't feel that they're beholden to you. We never think of it that way. Usually we think the ethical thing is to say, forget it, pass, leave it alone, I wouldn't hear from it. But he says, that's not always the lesson. Sometimes you have to let people reciprocate to you. But also that has to be, you have to know how and when. You have to know how and when. You see, we have along the same lines, a little different, but it's worth it to mention now. You'll remember it when it comes to Purim, or you remember it in general. When it comes, for example, to Mishloach Manot, where our community fulfills this mitzvah in a very, very grand way. We prepare 20, 30, 50, 60 of them, and everybody that comes, we give. But I want to point out something. I mention it every year. I think we do the mitzvah in a